You're listening to Stop Think Science, Episode 9. Today we talk to Greg's brother Ben about wine and the winemaking industry.
You can pair any good wine with anything you want. So if you have a Premier Cru Burgundy Chardonnay, you can pair that with your New York strip steak.
You are listening to Stop Think Science. Please buckle your seatbelts and put your tray tables in the upright position. You are about to embark on a journey through science and technology. Get ready to learn and expand your mind. Are you ready?
Hi, Stop Think Science listeners. This is John Milligan here with today's version of Which of These Things Is Not Like the Others? Today, we'll think about which of these two things is not like the other one in terms of what chemicals it has. So let's think. Blood, carrots, and eyeballs. Take a few seconds and think about it. If you thought that blood is not like carrots and eyeballs, you're correct. The reason is because eyeballs have a chemical called retinol, and carrots have a chemical called carotene. Both of these chemicals have long chains of what we call olefins, or double bonds. These double bonds actually make what's called a conjugated system, which kind of acts like a molecular wire. It transmits electrons all the way up and down. And when we have a lot of these conjugated bonds together, the molecules actually behave with light, which is why carrots appear orange, and why when light interacts with our eyeballs, we get images sent to our brain, because the light interacts with this long conjugated system, making changes in the molecule that our brain interprets as images. Blood is also colored red, of course, but that's from a different reason. That has a molecule called a heme in it that binds a metal, iron, and causes a red color. It's a similar mechanism, but the structure of heme is much different than carrots. So therefore, carrots and eyeballs have a similar molecule, surprisingly, and blood, although it has a color to it, it comes from a different type of molecule. Thanks for playing. We'll see you again next time on Stop Think Science.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Stop Think Science. Tonight we're recording episode 9, Fermented Grapes and Why We Love Them, or The Science of Wine. Our expert guest tonight is my older brother Benjamin. This is Greg, by the way. You can't recognize our voices at this point. A little bit about Ben. He attended Allegheny College and ultimately graduated with a Bachelor's of Science in Chemistry and Spanish. During his undergraduate study, he studied Spanish in Seville, Spain for a semester, completed summer research internships in medicinal chemistry at Amgen in Thousand Oaks, California, as well as in total synthesis at the University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. After his graduation from Allegheny, he continued his chemistry studies at the University of Pittsburgh, where he worked for Dr. Peter Whipp on several medicinal chemistry projects using peptide mimetics and small molecules for the inhibition of biologically interesting targets. While at Pitt, he completed an online certificate program in winemaking through the University of California Davis Extension. After he graduated with his Master's of Science in Organic Chemistry, he completed harvest internships at Viña Santa Catalina in Totihue, Chile, Frank Family Vineyards in Calistoga, California, and Tresadum Winery in Newburgh, Oregon. He currently works as a cellar hand at Rex Hill Vineyards and A to Z Wineworks in Newburgh, Oregon. Today, he's taking a break from bottling to answer a few questions for us about the science behind the wine industry. Welcome, Ben. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So just to kind of get things started off, we'll be doing something a little bit different tonight that I'll be leading the discussion. I think Ian will be more of an observer and jumping into the conversation.
Sounds good.
So kind of to get things started off, is there anything from the intro that I missed that might be important to our discussion today, or anything you'd like to clarify?
No. Other than the fact that bottling has not been going well, the bottling truck, the one screen that controls most of the truck, hasn't been working. So we haven't bottled Monday, Tuesday,
I'm actually off work tomorrow because we're going to hopefully have it up and running by midday Thursday, and then bottle Friday and Saturday of this week. So
let me jump in here, Greg. I'm speaking for the non-wine experts that are going to be listening here. What is the full life cycle for, say, a bottle of wine?
So post-harvest, the grapes will kind of slowly go on into a state of hibernation, much like most trees. They'll drop all their leaves. They'll turn into, like, hardwood. And that's what you'll see in the winter. You'll see, like, the kind of the trellising system holding up a bunch of what looks like twigs. And that'll be how the grapes will sit till about – or the vines will sit till about January. And somewhere in January or February, your vineyard crew will come through and prune all those vines back to a certain number of buds. The buds will be what will produce the next year's fruit. Will come out of, along with that entire fruiting cane that the grapes will actually be growing off of. So as the year goes on, you'll slowly start to see the clusters form from the flower. And then from there, the clusters will start out, all of them, in a green sort of state. Veraison is when the grapes start to change color and become more red for the red varietals. And even some of the varietals that make white wine actually have slightly pink red skins, like Pinot Gris, Gewürztraminer, actually have colored skins. But when they get to the winery, they're processed differently and thus not retaining that color in the actual finished wine. A picking decision is made based on several different things depending on the winery. Usually it involves some element of taste, looking at the bricks, so the amount of sugar that's in the wine, which gives you your potential alcohol at the end of fermentation, titratable acidity, and pH. All of these factors are usually examined. Some other things are tested, but they're more for the final wine. And then from there, the wine will be, for the reds, will go into a fermentation tank. There'll be a certain level that'll be destemmed, so removed from the grape stems. Sometimes you maintain some of those stems for flavor components that you want to add. It'll go through the process of primary fermentation, and then at some point there'll be a decision to press that red wine. So you'll drain all of the juice or must or wine, depending on what state of the fermentation it's in. So juice would be mostly sugar. Must is a fermentation that's somewhere between sugar and alcohol. The wine would be the 100% conversion to alcohol, zero sugar remaining. Well, the red grapes will get pressed, and then they'll go into either a tank or a barrel for some sort of aging and storing before bottling. For the white wines, when they arrive at the winery, they'll generally be immediately pressed. And that's how you get away from those grapes like Gewürztraminer or Pinot Gris that have the colors in their skin. You won't end up with color in the final wine. And even if when you initially press that juice, it has a little bit of color, the fermentation will actually cause that to disappear. You'll see a change in color. Same thing when you do oxidative winemaking with Chardonnay. The juice, when it gets oxidized, will turn really, really dark brown. So it'll look like kind of like cinnamon sugar applesauce, super, super like brown colored because of the oxidation that's going on in that juice. But the fermentation will convert it to like the golden Chardonnays that you see in store just by the consumption of those molecules in that fermentation, the conversion to other compounds. And then the white wine, since it's pressed before fermentations, going to get fermented either in a barrel or a tank, depending what it is. And it'll have some sort of aging in a barrel or tank. And generally, white wines are bottled sooner than the reds for logistical reasons and also for stylistic reasons. Some white wines that you'll get to see held longer will be some of the Chardonnays that are Surlys aged, which means that they're aged on top of the lees. Of the high, pretty much the yeast cells that fell to the bottom after they died post fermentation, and the theory or thought behind that is that they're looking to extract certain esters that'll be released from those yeast cells as they open up and lyse.
Is into that the, for so. Flavor or smell or like aroma?
A little bit of both. You get mouthfeel, so that'll be more of a flavor component. And then the smell, there definitely is distinctive aromatic esters that you would get from that. You'll get like the yeasty aromas. You'll get some different aromatic esters will come out of that. Different fruit components will come forward. Because a lot of the flavors and smells that you get from wine, a lot of them will be there. But if they're not there in the perfect mix, you won't get that coming forward in the actual glass. And that's a lot of what we don't understand is, you know, how much of this chemical contributes to this chemical, contributes to this balance of components in wine that we perceive as this. I mean, there's definitely a disconnect between flavor and, or actually taste and the smell of wine compared to, like, chemically what is exactly causing that in every single bottle of wine. Because there's so much diversity in the initial grapes coming in and what the winemaker can do with them. And then the region to region and vineyard to vineyard variances, it's almost impossible to come up with, like, just a formula. So taste has a huge component in winemaking and dictating winemakers' style and what they want to do throughout the entire lifetime of the wine till it's in a bottle, from grape till finished product.
So we kind of mentioned, or I guess I kind of mentioned at the beginning, that you have a background in chemistry. And it sounds like there's a lot of, at least general organic chemistry terms that you're throwing around. How much did your scientific background help you with learning about winemaking and doing these kind of processes to analyze what you're doing?
So winemaking is a lot of unit conversion because since it was an old world thing, everything's in metric. I mean, almost all of the products we buy are in kilogram bags, or the products will be in a certain dosage per liter. So you spend a lot of your time, since Americans are very resistant to converting, all of our tanks are in gallons. There was a period where the winery I currently work at, since our winemaker is a Kiwi and our vineyard manager is actually an Aussie. So we have, and then our assistant winemaker is actually French. So we have quite a metric heavy favoring group at the winery. There was some talk of making a metric only winery. Realistically, the only things we work in the standard system particularly are gallons and Fahrenheit. But most of the additions and adds that we'll do to tanks and anything that requires things to be weighed out or liters to be measured is all done in metric. So we do kind of that general chemistry sense. Yeah, so there's some of that. And then, I mean, obviously there's all the lab work and analysis of the wines. Winemaking is a lot of titration, a lot of old school chemistry, or baby chemistry, as people, I've heard people refer to it. To me, wine chemistry labs generally aren't super dangerous labs. most of the danger to your health would be the chemicals we use out in the cellar that clean the tanks. We do use, you know, 5-gallon buckets of caustic, so like a 50% sodium potassium hydroxide caustic thick solution to clean tanks. So like a lot of the risk is more on a big scale when it comes to chemistry. Anytime you go to dig out a tank, for example, post-fermentation, the tank's going to be massively full of CO2, and there's CO2 pockets that can be buried in the actual grape skins and seeds that are in the tank after you drain all the juice out. So there's some logistical risks to that, but most of the wine chemistry is pretty straightforward. Most of the danger to health and hazard is actually in the physical cellar, what the cellar workers deal with.
Okay. So what initially sparked your interest to work with wine?
So I'd done that internship in Amgen, so I kind of saw that career track for an organic chemist. And then I was in graduate school, and I definitely didn't want to be my advisor and just write grants all day. So I needed to find like another outlet for my training that I had. And I definitely wanted to spend more time outside, which I spend some time outside walking between our buildings now. But there is more opportunities you advance and become more of a head winemaker that you'll get to spend more and more time outside, passing through the vineyard near closer to harvest and just being involved in that side of the business. Generally, a lot of what I do now is purely winemaking. I spend my day at the winery, and the grapes will magically arrive for us in a few weeks being picked in bins from the vineyard. But the initial thought was to be able to spend more time outside at some point, and it just seemed like a good avenue. I did grow up with wine from our grandpa. Obviously, Gregory knows the answer to this question.
Right.
But there was that always around, so that's how I was initially interested in wine. But that wasn't necessarily the reason that I decided to go down this path. It was more I was looking for an outlet for the training that I had. And winemaking lets me, you know, play around and do physical labor too all day. So, you know, I get a little bit of chemistry plus a little bit of athleticism. So it's fun.
Yeah, I think that probably Grandpa being in winemaking more had to do with just exposing you to the idea than maybe thinking about working in the industry, because he until recently, he wasn't as analytical about things, which is what you kind of have to do and what you've been describing. So, I guess getting back into the winemaking process, as to kind of switch gears here, as a bottle of wine ages, you kind of mentioned what sounded like how you worry about aging wine before it reaches the consumer. But what happens maybe versus, so I guess this would be before and after, aging a wine in a barrel versus aging in the bottle. What chemically happens there? Is that going to improve all wines similarly if you had a $15 bottle of wine versus a $45 bottle of wine or something like that? If you could comment on that process and what it actually does to what we consume in the end.
So pretty much from the time fermentation finishes, it's more or less a slow decay. It's whether that decay leads to something positive or negative, mostly by the influence of oxygen. Also, there's a combining of compounds that occur. So you have tannin molecules that can polymerize and create longer and longer chains of those that'll become more stable or less stable and they'll drop out of the wine. Same with tartaric acid. You could have some tartrate instability that'll precipitate out of the wine over time. But wines that are aged in barrel pretty much are in what you could consider a non-sterile, a non-sanitized environment. I mean, they're aged in wood. Wood isn't easily sterilized. I mean, you can steam barrels, but it's not perfect. And then plus, obviously, the barrel over time, since it's made of wood, the wood wants to continuously hydrate itself. So as it's hydrating itself, it's pulling water out of the wine. So you're going to end up with a slight concentration of alcohol over time, as well as there's going to be a growing headspace in that barrel that had to be topped. Any headspace is a risk for air, for microbial growth. Whereas if you look at a bottle, if it is sealed properly with the proper closure and it's done well with that closure, is in theory a sterile environment that's going to be pretty impermeable to gases, and the wine's pretty well protected in that bottle. With that said, there's still a lifetime of that wine that it's going to hit a maximum quality level, and different wines at different price points are meant to be drank at different times. The average winemaker knows that if they tell the American consumer, you shouldn't drink this wine for 10 years, the person might hold it for a year, but is probably going to open it within a year. Whereas if you look at a lot of the old world wines, especially looking towards Burgundy, most places in Burgundy are still making wines, but they've had to curb the market a little bit recently, but are still making wines that are not meant to be open for 30 years. So the thought process about how you actually manipulate those wines before fermentation and after fermentation and control of the different flavor components and like the stringency of the red wines is all being dictated by when you think someone's going to open that bottle. Because when someone opens that bottle, then you, in theory, have someone that's going to give an opinion about the wine. And if it was drank too soon, they may not like it or find it pleasing.
So comparing wine to, say, liquor or whiskey, I guess specifically whiskey or bourbon is typically aged in barrels as well. With whiskey and bourbon, I believe they char those barrels. Do they char the barrels in wine, or would that cause problems?
So the winemaking barrels are charred or toasted, I guess would be the technical term. But there's different levels of toasting, and different levels of toasting will bring out different components. So you'll have like the heavier toastings will have a lot more smoke, whereas a lighter toasting you might get more of like different like nutty aromas that might come through, or like a vanilla. But like every barrel crooper is sourcing from different forests. Quite often in winemaking it's French oaks, so then it's French oak forest from certain areas of France, whether it's a specific forest or center of France. I mean, different things that make it more and more narrow where that wood came from dictate the barrel price to go up and up and up. Each cooper has their kind of in-house formula for toasting. Toasting isn't necessarily a perfect art. There has been some coopers that have tried to use parameters to narrow down like how long they're toasting, specifically at a certain temperature, their grains per inch in that specific board that goes into that barrel. But I've actually found that some of those coopers that do that actually had more variance barrel to barrel than some of the ones that didn't do that. So There's definitely a lot of options for wood seasoning and flavor in winemaking, but generally most people use French oak just because that's tradition. American oak and Hungarian oak impart very different flavors. There are different wineries that have sworn by using American oak, for example, but that's definitely not the standard in the winemaking industry. French oak carries kind of the prestige and the tradition and history, which is where a lot of things fall back into in winemaking is tradition and how we've always done it.
Just from like my curiosity, if you were to assign like a percentage of weight to how much influence does the barrel have on the wine versus say the grapes or the fermentation process or the yeast that you used?
So it depends how much new oak you use, because barrels pretty much have a 3-year lifespan when they're actually going to impart flavor on the wine. After that, they essentially become glorified small vessels that add a small amount of oxidation, aeration, a little bit of oxygen permeability into the wine compared to stainless steel tanks, which are pretty impermeable. So after that 3 years, the first year you get a very high amount of oak influence, second year a little bit less. It's probably more of a balanced wine by itself in that barrel. Third year you get like a slight, and fourth year it's kind of trailing off, and then fifth year it's pretty much no influence. But with the question for influence, it really depends on how much new oak. So how many brand new barrels are in that particular lot, and then what that particular wine is like. So if you took a Chardonnay, for example, that had not been fermented at oak and just stuck it in 100% new oak barrels, it's probably going to taste a lot like burnt toast and be really not quite good. But if you took different California cabs that have a lot of tannins and astringency and put them in 100% new oak, you might actually get like a balance when the wine's open 10 years down the road, because it's still going to be a very big wine. But it kind of all depends on what the initial wine is going in. So a lot of decisions about which cooper, which barrel, and what percentage of new oak go into different particular wine or vineyard lots is dictated by the style the winemaker wants to do, so how much oak influence do they want in that flavor. And then that actual wine itself, what does it need to be balanced? So there's a lot of stylistic questions and decisions that have to be made post-harvest for how much of a particular wine is going to go into oak. And then sometimes it's logistics. You don't have enough barrels. You don't have enough new barrels. So you have to
make do
out for your vineyard lots.
Yeah. So it sounds like from a science a scientific standpoint, at least, there's just a lot of variables that can come into play here. What are the most important things that you have to keep track of that could potentially ruin your batch of wine?
During fermentation, definitely temperature. Temperature, okay. And depending, like white wines are traditionally or normally fermented a lot colder than red wines. And red wines have the whole cap management issue where the grapes, as they ferment, the gases push all of the grape skins and the grapes themselves to the top of the tank. All of the juice and must settles down below it. So pretty much you need to have some sort of temperature control system on the tank, and that can be your make it or break it for fermentations. Because if the temperature gets too hot, the yeast will die off. They have limits for their lifetime too.
Okay. Another potential thing, I guess, switching to more like on the table when you're serving the wine or when the consumer actually has it, the just oxygen getting into your wine, doesn't that also cause problems?
It does. Oxygen is definitely something that you fight throughout the entire process, but during fermentation, oxygen can generally be considered good. The yeast need oxygen to build up their cell walls and to be able to survive the toxic environment they're essentially creating for themselves with the ethanol that's increasing as the fermentation goes on. So oxygen isn't necessarily always bad. People talk about micro-oxygenation both in barrels and through machines to kind of help a wine evolve earlier so that when it goes to market, if it's meant to be drank in a year, it's ready to be drank and you don't need to wait 10 years to open that particular bottle. So oxygen is kind of a good and bad thing, and it also goes with that whole stylistic thing. When's this wine going to be opened? What do I want this wine to taste like? Chardonnay particularly can be either made very reductively without oxygen throughout the whole process from the time you press the grapes to the end of fermentation, or it could be made oxidatively, and those are going to lead to two very different wines neither of which is going to be necessarily good or bad. It's just going to be a stylistic preference for what the winemaker wants to do with those grapes.
Now, this is going to be kind of a question out of left field, but as we were preparing for this episode, I was wondering, you have wine that's around that's made from different kinds of fruit. Is there a certain reason why grapes were kind of picked and have been the main source of fruit for the industry, or is it just kind of what tradition has put forth?
So grapes are very unique in the fact that compared to most fruits, they have generally pretty low pHs, and they have very high acids and also a great diversity of acids. Typically, the two acids you think of most are tartaric and malic, or most of the grape acids, but there's also citric and succinic, and like a lot of the acids you also think of in groups. But a lot of the flavors and stuff we talk about in the wine are yeast-derived flavors, but they're yeast-derived flavors that are produced from something that was initial metabolite that was in the wine. So wine's kind of one of those things that's just developed over tradition from years and years and years, much like beer. Beer's been made traditionally from wheat, if you go back to like Germany, all the Weiss beers. But the whole thing with grapes, a lot of it does bend down tradition, but it's also that there is very few other fruits that have the unique chemistry that grapes do.
So we talked a lot about your job as a winemaker and the technicalities of wine, but we'd like to hear a little bit about why you wanted to become a scientist in the first place. Was there any experience that sticks out?
I guess there's not one specific experience for that question. I was always good at chemistry and biology, like physics, and I enjoyed doing them. So I guess that's how I ended up going to college with that career focus in mind. I definitely was influenced by my eventual advisor at Allegheny, Dr. Murphy, to switch to chemistry. So my switch to chemistry was definitely dictated by that first chemistry class I took at Allegheny, and that's how I fell down that pathway more specifically and became really passionate about chemistry and interested in studying chemistry. But just to be a scientist in general, it was more I was good at it. I enjoyed it in high school, so that's what I went to college in. It wasn't really like there was one defining moment that stuck out, but definitely for the chemistry, it was that first class, chemistry, intro chemistry class I took with Dr. Murphy that defined that.
Was there any, I mean, in order to leave graduate school and to do something else, there probably had to be a moment that you made that decision, but what outside of that maybe, or if that was the moment, is there a time that sticks out to you that you just wanted to give up on science or change things completely, or just that you were having a rough time, I guess. It seems like that is a common theme among some scientists, at least. So we're curious what your input there would be.
Every single day that my NMR was not pure, I wanted to quit. I mean, honestly, I don't think there was necessarily one moment. I mean, I guess I did quit graduate school or leave graduate school early, but it wasn't that I hated what I was doing. I was definitely stressed out by what I was doing, but most people are stressed beyond belief in graduate school and like pushed to their limit physically, mentally, stress-wise. They always want to succeed and have their project work, but the joy of science is that it rarely ever works, and that research is usually results in a lot more failure than it does successes. But I think that there wasn't necessarily a defining moment, but it was always I was always very annoyed when I wouldn't get the compound through the high-res HPLC and, you know, get my mass spec data back from it, and it wouldn't be perfectly pure, like 99%. So that was always a little bit of the perfectionist. I wanted my compounds to be perfect coming off my column.
So do you have any advice for current students that may be in grad school that have the same feeling as you, that maybe, I don't know, feel that they're not in the right place? Do you have any advice for them changing career paths?
I would say find a mentor. I mean, I had a really close lab mate that was a postdoc. He's now back in Belgrade, Serbia. He's a professor there at the University of Belgrade. I talk to him a lot. See if there's some sort of older role model that you can kind of talk to outside of your advisor, just because your advisor obviously has other desires. They'd like to keep you in graduate school. But definitely at some point you have to come out and be honest with them if that's what you're looking to do and change direction. And I mean, I found a lot of support from my advisor when I came forward with my plan and what I wanted to do and why I wanted to do it. So he's definitely very supportive when I did actually tell him about it, when I was certain of my decision and kind of had mapped out how I would do it. But I think you definitely need some sort of postdoc or mentor, older graduate student within the group that can kind of help you with that. As for when to do it, I think you have to start thinking about and figure out ways to do it as soon as possible, because the fact that I did it so young makes it a lot easier for people that wanted to maybe break into the wine industry when they're 35. It's a lot harder to go around the world and work harvest when you have a family or when you're like 35 and you can't get student visas to get into Australia or New Zealand or whatever. You can always go to Chile like I did and work on a tourist visa illegally. There is like different ways to get around the traditional systems, but most countries will not allow you to just come into the country and work a harvest. And it's a lot harder when you're not student age to get those visas to come in and work, you know, for 3 or 4 months at a winery. So for that particular industry, younger is better. And for anyone, I mean, you kind of want to start your desired career as early as possible. I mean, graduate students want to graduate as early as possible so they can go work that job and make money and start building their resume towards, you know, what they eventually want to do in the end. So I would say as soon as you know what you want to do, you have to kind of pursue it.
Yeah, I think that sounds like great advice, really. I guess to wrap things up, we kind of have a question that we're going to start asking most of our guests. Do you have a favorite book that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
So if it's just a book, it'd be Tom Clancy, Rainbow Six.
Okay.
We're going with wine and chemistry themed. It's actually more wine business than anything, but it's a really good book. It's interesting to read. It's Wine Wars, The Curse of the Blue Nun, The Miracle of the Two-Buck Chuck, and The Revenge of the Terroirist. It's by Mike Vieseth, I guess would be how you pronounce his last name. Vieseth.
So that's pretty much everything we had to ask you today, Ben. Just to kind of wrap things up, today we talked a lot about the science behind wine and winemaking. Just also a little bit about Ben's change in career path from doing bench research to working at a winery and spending more time in the wine cellar and out in the vineyard. If anyone who's listening would like to learn more about these topics, please check out the links in the show notes, as well as the books that Benjamin recommended at stopthinkscience.com, or send us a question and we can forward it on to Ben if you'd like to ask him anything about wine or about graduate school or about Chile, anything along those lines. I'm sure he'd be happy to contribute to anything you're thinking. And we just also like to thank Ben for joining us today and contributing towards our kind of our backlog of information about different scientific topics, something that a lot of people can relate to, because a lot of our listeners who are over 21, of course, I'm sure like to drink wine. So thank you, Ben, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll catch you guys next week.
Thank you for listening to Stop, Think, Science. We are glad you could join us. Our success depends on you. Please subscribe to our show on iTunes. And if you're feeling generous, leave us a review. If you have comments or questions about anything that you heard today, don't hesitate to drop us a line at our website, www.stopthinkscience.com.